accession number 19040, reel 2.
Major Duckworth, reel 2.
I waved the carrier forward, and we proceeded from there.
And when you went out on a recce, would you have been given specific instructions as to what to do or what to look for, or did you have a free hand?
Well, on the whole, we had a free hand. Sometimes we were given specific instructions. The commanding officer wanted information about a certain spot or feature, and so we had to go and explore it. Otherwise, we were given a route to follow, and we just followed that route until we bumped the enemy. And when we bumped the enemy, we either went to ground and waited till the tanks came forward. Sometimes that wasn't possible, and the opposition was so strong that we were withdrawn. One or two occasions of that. On the whole, though, we had to fight when we made a contact, because quite often our contact was with infantry, the first one, but not always, because sometimes it might be with an SP gun on one occasion a Tiger. But on the whole, we went forward just feeling our way. I can remember one occasion when we were so often attached to a squadron for a specific operation. One troop might go with, say, B squadron. And I can remember clearly going on one day being told by B squadron commander that he wanted to know what was in a wood. And it looked a fiendishly impossible task in that, from the point where we were going to launch ourselves into the open, there was at least 1,000 meters of flat, open country to the next wood. And we had to motor across that. And luckily there were no anti-tank guns in opposition. We got near the wood. I had a very, very good man in my troop, in my car, called Jiggins. It was Trooper Jiggins, an improbable name for an improbable person, but extremely good, valuable crew member. And I remember waving him down, because it was always a competition. He was always trying to get ahead. And I said, look, it's no good of us, both of us going together. We'll both be hit with the same burst. You lie there for a minute and watch me into the wood. I went into the wood. And as I went in, I saw a movement ahead of me, and I didn't fire straight away, because it looked to me as though it was a German with his back to me. And sure enough, it was. And this little group of Germans who were in the wood and the front of it were actually retreating. And they went out the other side. And my corporal in the Bren carrier roared round the side of the wood and caught them coming out the other side. And so we took them all prisoner, which was a gratifying thing to do. It was always rather nicer to take a prisoner than to leave a corpse. And then Jiggins joined me, and we reported what we'd found, stayed there in an observing position for a while until we were pulled back, and we pulled back with our prisoners.
Where would that have occurred?
Near a town called Heesh. It was quite near Sir Togan Bosch, but it was going north, not going from Heesh directly to Sir Togan Bosch. It was going further north.
So this sounds like, this is obviously the autumn of 1944.
That's right.
And how long normally would you be out on a recce?
Could be all day. Quite often you started off before first light, and you weren't either recalled or didn't come back until very late in the night. I can remember going off in one patrol, which was really a flank protection role before a town called Montfort. And we literally went out before first light, and it was long after midnight before we were recalled. And I can remember sitting there in the brilliant moonlight and seeing all sorts of imaginary shapes coming towards us from time to time. And then eventually we were recalled, and as we always had to be, to refuel and replenish.
Where roughly is Montfort?
Montfort is a bit north of Maastricht, about, I don't know, 10 miles or 15 miles, I suppose.
How much contact were you having with civilians in the Low Countries?
Quite a bit, and on the whole, tremendously friendly. In particular, the Dutch. And I think the same thing applies to this day.
Would they be of any assistance to you or you to them?
Yes and no. Sometimes they gave information. Sometimes we got the wrong end of the stick on one notorious occasion. The farmer at this old ruined castle, I think, gave the wrong impression and said that there were no Germans in the area. And one of our recce troops had been reached the castle before first light, had interviewed the farmer, and so they decided they would brew up. And before they'd got the water hot for their char, German appeared on the ramparts of the castle with a bazooka, and they managed to escape, but they had to leave their Daimler scout car there with all its codes on and wireless frequencies and so on. And so that had to be brewed up, and the honey tank with its 37 millimeter brewed it up. But that was the case where the German farmer was subsequently arrested as a collaborator. But we had a splendid Belgian officer who had been in the Belgian resistance in the Premier Guide, who had joined us earlier in Belgium. And he went and talked to the farmer, and he discovered that he hadn't been a collaborator, and he hadn't deliberately misled us. And so that was settled. But from time to time, you got information from them. The Dutch called the Germans the Muffermen because they smelt musty. And they would say, "Well, the Muffer over there," or whatever. But our own sort of associations on the whole were with people who were very pleased to be liberated, who were very generous to a degree. They would give us perhaps their last egg, and there they were living and on the edge of, I won't say necessarily starvation, but very poorly fed. And we had knocked absolute hell out of their farmhouses and their villages. And yet, no animosity, no ill feeling at all. And in fact, I felt rather embarrassed. I went to this thing I told you about earlier, I think it was 1992. And they kept on talking about the war. And every civic dignitary who harangued us said, "The one thing we are absolutely certain is that we will never forget." And I would say that not one person who spoke to us could have been more than the age of 12 when we liberated them. They were marvellous. And I got so embarrassed eventually, I said, it's very nice to hear you say that, but you must realise that we were there with a certain degree of enlightened self-interest. And what made me personally, and many of us, feel very guilty, was that having devastated your farms and your houses and so on, like a plague of locusts, we moved on self-contained, leaving you to pick up the bits with very little facilities to do that with, which was my prevailing sentiment in much of the operation in Holland.
And that farmer whom you suspected of being a collaborator was a Dutchman?
Yes.
What else do you remember from the Low Countries?
I remember the night patrols before the great operation, which took us for the first time onto German soil proper. It was an operation called Black Cock, which was launched on, I think, the 16th of January in 1945. And prior to that, we used to operate a system of standing patrols on the bank of the Juliana Canal, principally. And the post that we had was right out in no man's land, you could say. It was surrounded by minefields. And we had to approach it after last light and leave before first light. And we sat there in the frozen wastes of Holland, taking it in turns, a troop at a time, so roughly we were on there every third night. For some reasons we weren't. One squadron of the regiment at this time was dismounted, the B squadron I think it was, and of course we were dismounted doing this patrol. And nothing untoward happened there really, except one night I was sitting looking out with my arms on the, what you might call the parapet, looking out across the frozen wastes, when I suddenly felt something on my arm. And I thought, well, it's a German sniffer dog. And I looked like that, and it wasn't. It was the most enormous rat. And then when we looked, we had a little dugout, which we slept in when we were not on what you might call stag. And we found it was absolutely riddled with rat holes.
Did you take part in the Reichswald operation?
No. We were on Black Cock, which was the Ruhr Triangle. That was clearing all the area north of Maastricht, really, to the River Ruhr. And our objective then was St. Odiljenberg, which was a town, again, almost north of Montfort. We went in three stages, Maastricht, and then further on Montfort, and then not so far on St. Odiljenberg.
Was that objective reached?
Oh, yeah, eventually, yes.
What happened after this?
Well, we were taken back into reserve. And I'm really very vague about what we did after that. We see we'd moved right the way across Holland from really virtually the Maas on one side. Well, again, for a certain length of time, we used to do morning patrols along the River Maas. And that meant getting out there before first light and driving along our bank of the Mars and seeing if there was anything untoward happening. Of course, on the other side of the river, there were a lot of barges, and the Germans were using the steerage part of the barge as their observation post, the wheelhouse. And occasionally we brassed those up and then pulled back to other positions of observation further back, because there was about 2 miles, I should think, certainly a mile, of, again, totally flat country between the river and the nearest cover.
And what happened when the Rhine crossing came?
Well, I missed that because I'd been sent back to Lulworth for a conversion course, or Bovington, on the new tank we were going to be equipped with, American Chaffee. But so I was away actually at that time, and I didn't return until the regiment had reached Munster.
What was your opinion of this Chaffee?
Oh, I thought it was a dream tank, and it was much bigger than anything we had. But it had a bigger gun, and it had all sorts of then up-to-date technology, tank technology. Perhaps it was a bit large for a reconnaissance vehicle. See, what we'd got used to using the three, but we'd really dispensed with the Bren carrier because it was so susceptible to mines. We'd had several Bren carriers knocked over with mines, and we eventually decided that the best vehicle for us was a Honey tank with its turret taken off, and on the turret ring we mounted 3 Browning machine guns, one in the center of the front and one on each side. And that answered some of our problems, because apart from mines and the obviously long-range guns, our worst fears were bazookas. And after we adopted this technique, we didn't have any trouble with bazooka men.
So you were in the push through Germany?
Yes, we went right up to just short of Hamburg.
Any memories of that?
Yes, I remember. I remember we captured Wildeshausen, and we were getting very. I think we were getting very. I can't say end of war happy, because unlike many people, I didn't think that it was going to end quite as soon as it did. But full of the joys of spring, we went into a hotel. The recce troop officers, recce squadron officers, went into a hotel in Wildeshausen and ordered a meal, dinner. And at the same time, in Wildeshausen was a gin factory, and that had been liberated with great glee by the soldiers, who were seen coming out carrying crates of gin, which was not good. Certainly with some elements supporting us, who got absolutely plastered and incapable. Not in my regiment, I'm happy to say, but some supporting cast. And we were just about to sit down to dinner when we heard the unmistakable sound of a Spandau. And so we got up and went out, and I can remember advancing along the street with my pistol in my hand, and at one stage seeing Tracer coming down the street ahead of me. And what had happened was that a German armored column, which had been reported by an intrepid platoon commander called Peter Bickersteth in the 1st Battalion of the Rifle Brigade as being in the area, and had passed him. He was on a standing patrol out, and he'd seen the column pass him. But no one seemed to take a great deal of notice of it until it suddenly arrived in Wildeshausen. And on its way in, I can't recollect now what damage it did. I know it knocked out a scout car and a jeep and A squadron. I think it did a lot of damage before it reached us. And the leader, fanatic and really courageous German officer with great blonde hair, was in the leading vehicle, and he got within striking distance of RHQ before he was knocked out by, and I'm not sure, I had a feeling it was a regimental headquarter tank, but it could have been an A squadron tank. I just don't remember now. But anyway, it was knocked out, and that blocked the road, and the column had to turn round and get out. But that was the saving thing. But it was a very nasty incident overall. And I think it would only came about through, I think you can say, negligence.
Where is Wildeshausen?
Wildeshausen is, I should think it's probably southeast of Bremen.
And the man who led the attack, counterattack, was killed?
Yes, it was a rather unpleasant sight.
What was the attitude of German civilians towards you as you passed through?
On the whole, pretty obsequious. There are some surly, but some very anxious to please, and depressed, I would say.
And after Wildeshausen, you went where?
Went back towards Hamburg and Harburg, and we captured Harburg. Well, we went along before Harburg, we went along the Elbe, south bank of the Elbe. And there was a place there, and now the name eludes me, where they had a barracks, and they had a lot of German equivalent of Wrens, German girls, sailors. And there were quite formidable fortifications along there. And I remember our B squadron, I think it was lined up, ready to go to cover a force going in. And eventually they captured a fellow, a German, who said that his job had been to detonate mines, and the mines were actual German sea mines, buried on the ridge that the tanks were on. And if he'd actually pressed the plunger, I think one or two of our tanks would have gone. But that was fortuitous. And then the Wrens were, I think, I wasn't with B Squadron then, but I did go along the canal a bit afterwards, along the Elbe afterwards, and through this town, and I can't remember what it's called. And then, anyway, we got to Harburg, and the surrender had been arranged. And I had then just been appointed signals officer. And my job was to establish communications in Harburg. And I was given a rendezvous. And I jumped the gun. And I'd been out along the Elbe, and I came back along, when I say I'd been out along the Elbe, I was a bit south of the bank, but not on the bank, and I came back more or less along the bank of the Elbe into Harburg. And as I went, I saw lots of German policemen all armed to the teeth with their Lugers and things. So I disarmed them as I went. And then not seeing anybody from the regiment where I thought they would be, I drove back south to see a huge gathering just outside, which included my brigadier, my commanding officer, squadron leaders, and heaven knows what, all assembled, waiting to receive the surrender of Harburg. And I drove out, so that all I could do was, sitting in my scout car, was chop off a salute and go past as insouciantly as I possibly could.
And after this?
Well, we went in, we had the surrender of Harburg. We gather that Lew Lyon, who was the general, had issued an ultimatum to Hamburg, which would have been a fearsome task fighting through, that if you don't surrender, you will be bombed. And you will probably recall that Bremen the other day was bombed with 1,000 bombers and was pretty well destroyed. We now have 20 times that number of bombers available to bomb you. If we have to do that, it'll set back your recovery many, many years. And they took his advice and surrendered. And so we drove through, and this was really getting to the end of the war, when one realized one was sort of seeing the tape. And we drove over the bridge, over the Elbe, into Hamburg. And the desolation was really eye-opening, even though one would have seen villages destroyed. To see a town like Hamburg practically laid flat, as far as the eye could see, was ruin. And you saw people coming out of their cellars from underneath rubble. And then we got towards the centre. The destruction seemed much less. Round the Ulster, the lakes, and most of the buildings around there seem to be more or less intact. But then we went out north to a place called Pinneberg, which I suppose is now part of Hamburg, but it was a separate little, I suppose, large village, where we spent the night of the when they surrendered. And as I recall it, the whole regiment was lined up along a road through the village and beyond. And we, at any one stage, you were never out of earshot of Winston Churchill's speech announcing the surrender. Every tank had it, had its wireless giving out. And from there we went up to the Kiel Canal and a bit beyond, but based ourselves generally either on the canal or just south of it. And then our job was to bottle up the German army, who were all shepherded into areas F and G, which was on the Schleswig-Holstein coast. And it